Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 120. A brief overview of post-conquest Latin American history. Part 5, the early 20th century. Before we get into things today, I just quickly wanted to mention that this month's Friends of the Podcast episode has just been released. It's the second of two parts about the pirates of Campeche, and it tells the story of a pirate community which existed for decades on the Mexican coast. And it includes information drawn from a first-hand account of a man who lived among those pirates. So if that sounds interesting, and you want to gain access to future episodes and the growing back catalogue, there's a link in the episode description with information about how to sign up and support the podcast by becoming a friend of the show. So the last two episodes of this main series have been quite heavy on war and grand conflicts. We did look at some of the social factors shaping Latin America in the 1800s, mainly the political visions of the liberals and conservatives, and the end of slavery, which of course had massive social consequences for a large part of the region's population. History is much more than battles and presidents, however. Now we have a chance to look a bit more at the internal dynamics of Latin America's nations, shaped partly by those presidents, of course, but also by movements which came from below. This episode covers the beginning of the 20th century, and across the globe, this century is sometimes known as the Age of Ideology. Perhaps most obviously, its second half saw the world divided between ideologies in the Cold War, but it was actually during the first part of the century that those ideologies rose. The Second World War was a battle between three ideologies, democracy, fascism, and communism, but they didn't appear overnight. They grew in popularity during the time this episode covers, and it was no different in Latin America. All of this is to say that this episode will be quite heavy on discussions of political ideas and abstract concepts. There are different ways of doing history. Some might rely heavily on statistics and emphasize the role of economic conditions in driving events. Others might use arts, culture, and writing to examine what people were thinking at the time being discussed. I'm aware that I'm pretty much completely neglecting this second side of things, but we will look at that stuff in future episodes. I guess what I'm trying to say is that, for this period in particular, I personally believe that ideas, good, bad, and neutral, are the most interesting aspect, because they are what shape events, including how things like economics and art are managed. An overview like this can never tell the story of everything that was going on, but I believe that this is the best way to provide the most comprehensive overview possible. We have seen how the political disputes of the 1800s were largely a matter for the rich upper-class criollos. It was they who were directing the fighting. Yes, among the liberals there was some desire for wider social reform, and those fights led to some changes in the social order. Again, the end of slavery is a big example, as is the adoption of market economies, which in principle, if not always in practice, lifted social restrictions and allowed anyone to improve their social status through the power of money. Across the Western world, however, things were changing. The lower classes were starting to demand greater participation and opportunity, while the Great Depression led people to search around for new ways of doing things. This would upend Latin America, along with the rest of the world. In one way, Latin America was ahead of many of its contemporaries when it came to this swell of popular agitation. The years leading up to the Second World War were marked by colonial independence movements, and many countries around the world became sovereign states in the wake of that conflict. Latin America had already achieved this. One of the things which makes this period so interesting is the interplay between the global and the local. Global trends had always affected the Latin American story. I have highlighted how the Spanish and Portuguese played a big role in creating that globalized world through things like the Manila galleons and the international silver trade. Now that the world was well and truly connected, one event or idea could impact everywhere. In each place, though, that thing would arrive into a set of pre-existing conditions, which would modify the way in which it manifested itself. Hopefully you'll see what I mean by the end of this episode. So in other ways then, despite the early advanced past colonialism, the region was quite traditional. Social structures and the distribution of wealth, largely still defined by land ownership, still concentrated resources into the hands of a relatively small group, while the power of feudal lords in places like Britain had been challenged by a new industrial class of factory owners. In Latin America, the power of this group, and the people who belonged to it, had roots all the way back in that old conquistador model of conquest, which saw land and encomiendas handed out to Spaniards who fought alongside people like Cortes and Pizarro. The Industrial Revolution had helped to propel Britain to global power, and industrialization was soon adopted by the US and other parts of Europe. No such change happened in Latin America at this time. The word campesino, roughly translating to peasant, is still used in Latin America today sometimes, often by those campesinos themselves. The idea of peasants existing in the West is pretty much non-existent, and conjures up visions of the medieval era. There, industrialization had turned many rural poor into an urban working class. This was happening much less in Latin America. Legacies of the old race-based classifications persisted, despite changes like the end of slavery. Women were not yet allowed to vote, although in this Latin America didn't differ much from its contemporaries. There were stirrings to challenge these identity-based classifications, but for the most part this was the age of class politics. At this time, groups like the Charterists were marching in Britain, and the failed revolutions of 1848 swept continental Europe. It's often overlooked, but the 1800s were extremely violent in the USA, as labour disputes pitted workers against industrialists. And of course, in 1917, the Russian monarchy was replaced with the world's first major communist government. In Western countries, part of the reason for these changes was that growth of cities and the development of the urban working class. While that wasn't happening as much in Latin America, the ideas were still filtering through. The writings of Karl Marx were, of course, enormously influential in all of this, but you didn't have to be a Marxist to seek class-based social change. That said, ideologies derived from his writing will find an audience hungry to embrace them among some Latin Americans. A significant part of the population was no longer willing to accept the gradual change proposed by the liberal parties, no matter how intolerable and radical their conservative counterparts found them. Some people wanted more. When I introduced the liberal-conservative disputes, I talked about how it would be a mistake to equate them to political arguments taking place today, even if the labels people use to describe the positions are sometimes the same. You can, however, trace a line of evolution if you choose to. The details are very different. Communism is not the same as free market centre-left liberalism, and modern conservatism does not generally advocate a return to slavery and to make the Catholic Church one of the most powerful institutions. But I guess you can say that the positions relative to each other do have some continuity. The left-right dichotomy remains, even if the desires of each have changed. The big difference which occurred in the early 20th century, Latin America was a bit behind other Western countries in this regard, was that often the left-wing demands now came from below rather than above. I don't want to make it sound like everyone was a revolutionary, and a bit later in this episode, we'll look at right-wing ideas as well. There were plenty drawn to the right, and some of the liberals found their positions being recast as right of centre. Those on the right valued stability. They could point to the indefinite civil wars which had already happened as evidence that stability was needed, and later to the many more which were to come. This had set their countries back and weakened them, they argued. Pragmatism was, and is, another hallmark of their position. It might not be perfect, but by accepting the reality of the market economy which ruled, and rules, economic orthodoxy, as well as the simple fact that the USA was the power and working with them was better than opposing them, they would achieve better results in the long run. There will be many strands to left-wing thought in Latin America, but two of the most basic strands began to establish themselves at this point. The first was the desire to break down the traditional power and wealth distributions. That may be through socialism, anarchism, identity-based movements, or movements which don't declare allegiance to a wider ideology. The second was resistance to the actions of the USA, both in terms of state intervention, but also the economic ideology it was wedded to, and the presence of the corporations which were thought to benefit from it and play a role in implementing it. Today there are two major strands of conservative thought which sometimes intertwine and sometimes generate tension. This is true in Europe and the English-speaking world as well. On the one hand, the traditionalist position harks back to that earlier time of social order. This is the conservative position in Latin America of the 1800s. But there's also a free market position, which is actually closer to the 1800s liberal economic ideas, and sees capitalism as the ultimate way to generate wealth. Much of the Latin American left wing opposes both, but it often argues that the US imposition of capitalist market economics and the activities of its corporations in the region is what they sometimes call neo-colonialism, which seeks to extract the region's wealth in a different, but in some ways similar, way to the Spanish shipping of the silver of Potosí back to Europe. We touched on this last episode when we looked at the Banana Wars and the activities of United Fruit. And so an interesting consequence of this is the concept of economic nationalism. Nationalism is a right-wing concept in the West, and as we shall see, this standard understanding of it would absolutely influence this period of Latin American history. Yet here, another economic form of the concept developed, which is often a left-wing idea. It seeks to keep hold of the nation's resources for the benefit of that nation, whereas the right often believed that the path to economic development involved engaging with the global market, using the things Latin America had at its disposal, often its resources. Now, I should quickly point out here that conflict between some Latin Americans and foreign corporations was not new, and it was not invented by the USA. Various European nations had backed up the activities of their corporations, and the British were probably the most active. UK companies had been heavily involved in Argentina, for example, building new railways and buying beef. Some historians and Argentines have argued that these investments were exploitative, as due to the strength of both the country and its corporations, the balance of power when agreements were made was far from even. The French invasion of Mexico can also be cited as an example. The Mexican conservatives had traditionalist reasons for collaborating. They wanted a monarchy, but the reason given for the invasion by the French was unpaid debts, and those debts were to European banking companies and the private citizen bondholders of Europe. Now, I haven't given this overview of left-wing Latin American thought as a way of advocating for it. It's just that you simply can't understand Latin American politics in the period we're covering in this episode and right up to the present day without understanding these ideas. Let's look at a couple of examples of how these ideas manifested from the time period we have reached. A really obvious and consequential one is the Mexican Revolution. I imagine that one day I'll do a series on the revolution, and that the causes will probably take several episodes to examine. I don't want, then, to make it sound like you can boil it all down to left-wing egalitarian ideas. I can't not talk about it when covering this period, however, and I can't explain it properly and briefly here. And so, one important strand of the revolution illustrates the power of these new ideas and the desire to tear down the old social structures. In this case, it's the ideology of Emiliano Zapata and his followers, who wanted radical land redistribution and sought to see ordinary citizens and indigenous peoples in particular gain access to land. This was different too, and went much further than the previous liberal positions. The idea of communally owned ejido forms of land ownership contrasted with liberal reforms, which had seen those lands handed over to the free market. Those reforms also bring us on to another new difference when it came to the level of radicalness. Alongside those communal ejido lands, the liberals had forced the church to sell off its estates. This was part of their campaign to separate church and state, and had contributed to the reform war which had seen conservatives push back and led to the subsequent French invasion which saw that Austrian monarch put in charge. Once the revolution had succeeded, however, the attacks on the church went much further and resulted in a conflict known as the Cristero War, in which Catholics rose up against these measures, and soon they and their priests were being hunted down. Other examples of 20th century and previously radical aspects of the revolution included the prominent role of women in the fighting, and restrictions put in place when a new constitution was written afterwards, which restricted foreign corporations operating in Mexico. So you can see in the calls for land reform that the poorest members of society were agitating for more, while physical, rather than just constitutional, attacks on the Catholic Church were much more serious than what had come before. Those restrictions on foreign corporations also would not have happened during the preceding century. This was a new type of revolution, inspired at least in part by the new ideas we spent the beginning of this episode discussing. The revolution succeeded in upending the old social order, but its results are complex. Various revolutionary leaders were killed or turned on each other, including Emiliano Zapata, and eventually the Institutional Revolutionary Party, a tautology if ever there was one, was created to stabilize things. It would rule Mexico until the year 2000. While it was not one of the major events of this period, a relatively famous illustration of the power of American corporations in Latin America, the willingness of both the US and local governments to support them, and the new demands being made by working people, can be found in the Banana Massacre. Its fame comes from the fact that it was fictionalized in Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. Workers in northern Mexico went on strike from the plantations owned by United Fruit, demanding better and more regularly paid wages, improved healthcare, and a 6-day working week, among other things. The Colombian government sent in the army, which opened fire on the strikers, while the US Navy sent a ship to the Caribbean to keep an eye on things. There is a concept in political sociology known as the Overton Window. To be clear, it was developed in the 1990s, so one, nobody was talking about it during this period, and two, it emerged during a period of relatively measured political debate, when there were fairly clear bounds to acceptable discourse. I think it's useful, however, for understanding this period of Latin American history. There is more to it than this, but its basic principle is that if all the possibilities of politics can be laid out on a left-to-right scale, then there is a smaller window of political argument which is considered sensible. This window might be in different positions on that spectrum, at different times and in different places. A right-wing position, at the far edge of the window, during the 1990s in the USA, is obviously in a different place to that far edge in 1930s Germany. So too is the left side of that window. There were communist radicals in 1930s Germany, so perhaps the best way of looking at it is that the window was much wider at that point than it was in 1990s America. The old liberal criollo position had sat on the left side of the window during the 1800s in Latin America. Anything more radical was considered beyond the pale. While this didn't make political disputes any less fierce, as demonstrated by all the civil wars, it meant that the leftmost edge of political debate consisted of demands which were much less radical to the existing social order than ideas like Marxism or anarchism. Now, though, that these ideas were taking hold amongst parts of the population, that left side of the window had moved considerably further left. For some, this was alarming, and an equivalent sliding of the window in the other direction was needed to counteract it. Tied to this was the impact of the Great Depression, felt in Latin America as much as anywhere else. Plenty of places with plenty of different economic bases suffered during the Depression. Latin America's reliance on exporting resources made it vulnerable because it needed a market abroad to sell their stuff to, and those markets were in trouble. In Brazil, the reliance on coffee proved to be a problem as demand dropped off, exports halved, and the government bought up the redundant harvests of plantations, which they then set on fire or threw into the sea. As wasteful as this seems, they wanted to stop those plantations from going bust and to reduce the supply in an effort to make prices rise. Peru was one of the hardest hit, and its exports may have fell by around 70%. This, of course, had a corresponding impact on employment. Neighbouring Chile was also severely impacted, partly because it too relied on the export of resources and raw goods, and partly because it was particularly exposed to foreign debt, as it had recently sought investment to develop those export industries. All of this, as well as wider global changes in economic policy, such as the abandonment of the gold standard, meant that by 1934, three-quarters of Latin American governments had defaulted on their national debt.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now, I used 1930s Germany as an example a minute ago, while we are now in that time period. Around the world, faith in free market economics was failing, and logically consistent alternatives can be found on both the left and the right. We've looked at the left already. Those striking workers and Zapatista supporters wanted the state to intervene and to protect them from their bosses and the fickleness of international demand and price fluctuations. Or, another demand was to take things like land out of the hands of the market. Strongman politics, though, is another way of opposing liberal economics, which comes from the right. And so, as in Europe, strongmen started to appear. If communism is an example of an ideology which advocates the people coming together for the collective good, fascism and similar ideas also advocate the nation working together as part of a whole. Both subordinate the individual to the greater whole, that is, the nation for fascists and the workers' collective for communists. This can be compared to the individualism of the free market, which argues that people making choices is what drives the economy and society. So now, many of the old conservative elites had come to terms with the liberal economic order. Beyond qualitative concerns about tradition, they also worried about their own place and wanted to preserve their control of land and production. During Spanish rule, there had been conduits through which goods and wealth could flow, They had realized that they could still fulfill this role in a capitalist economy. What they couldn't tolerate were the new left-wing ideologies, which directly sought to take their wealth and status away. Now, though, in the wake of the Depression, their faith too was shaken. I mentioned that economic nationalism had emerged as a left-wing idea in Latin America. Well, although not on the scale as in Europe, more conventional nationalism with its right-wing connotations also grew in popularity to some extent. As we've seen, historically conservatism, tradition and the social order were vested in the king and the church. The army was the state's mechanism of enforcement, and so it held great power, but it was subordinate. Now with those institutions declining, it became a source of power and order in its own right, behind which conservatism could manifest. Its rise was solidified during all those border wars of the last century, where the new nations, looking to build a sense of national unity, pride and identity, as well as to define their territorial extents, fought against each other, and the armies they did this with attempted to win glory for their countries. If the Mexican Revolution was an example of a new type of revolution in Latin America, in 1924, the region also saw the first of a new type of coup, different to the previously liberal versus conservative ones, where each side had sought to replace their opponents. It happened in Chile, and the story of this period in that country's history demonstrates one continuation from those previous coups, in that the army could favour either left or right, depending on circumstance. The 1924 coup saw a fascist-style dictator put into power, but his administration only lasted 7 years before the Depression undermined him, and the army again intervened to put a socialist into office. To this day, dictators in Latin America don't have to be right-wing, even if many of them are. What made these coups different was the role of the army. The relationship between the dictators of the right and fascism in Europe is complex. Many, and a wave of them were about to sweep across the region, did talk of their admiration for Mussolini and his corporatist ideas. Some parties explicitly said that their ideology was copied from Italy, although they didn't always win power. Many, though, drew inspiration from the concept, but put their own slants on it, adapted to local conditions. In that general reaching around for new ideas to oppose free market liberalism, with potential alternatives coming from both left and right, Mussolini himself equivocated between the two sides during his early rise to power, before eventually settling on the right. Although he came to power just after the end of the period we're discussing here, the man whose shadow looms large over Argentina, Juan Domingo Perón, is a good example of this. As a colonel, he took part in a military coup against a conservative government. He was not afraid to talk of his admiration for Mussolini, and to import aspects of his ideology. Yet he was also close to trade unions, as well as praising the Cuban Revolution, and he got on very well with Che Guevara whenever they met. The flirtations of some Brazilians with fascism is interesting. They look towards the Portuguese equivalent more than the fascism of Italy. Integralism, as it was known, was still a hierarchical, state-based theory, popular among the armed forces. It made a point of rejecting the race-based views of Hitler and Mussolini, however. It would be difficult to fully advocate a fusing of nation and ethnicity in such a multi-ethnic country. It also espoused all sorts of theoretical ideas related to spiritualism, the struggle of man over nature, and internal, individual self-development. We came across the integralists in the episode on the vaccine revolt in Rio de Janeiro, and looked at how its manifesto had roots in French philosophy. At some point I will have to research it further, and get my head around what appears to be a fairly unique set of ideas. Now while we are here, we might as well quickly follow up on Brazil's history, and the end of Dom Pedro II's reign, which we covered last episode. We saw how his rule had been popular and beneficial for his country, bringing stability and economic growth. I also mentioned, however, that he personally came to resent his position and its demands. There is a saying that the people who would make the best politicians are those who have no desire to hold power, while those who seek out power are often the ones who do so for the wrong reasons. If you subscribe to that idea, then, Dom Pedro is probably a good example of this. Towards the end of his reign, privately he admitted that he had grown weary and indifferent to his position, although his sense of duty meant that he still carried it out to the best of his abilities. To some extent, he was a victim of his own success and longevity. The generation entering politics at the end of his reign had not seen how he had stabilised the country, and perhaps took some of that stability which he had created for granted. He was not active in defending his contribution. This was still a monarchy, albeit a very different one to the old iterations, and so the problems of succession which monarchy can bring was also looming over his old age. Two sons had died, and he shared the opinion of many of his critics that a man was needed for the job, ruling out his surviving daughter. In the end, a group of Republican military officers launched a coup. Dom Pedro seems almost to have been pleased to give up power, and the coup was quick and bloodless. He and his family went into exile, and he died not too long later. Some soldiers who favoured monarchy did launch small uprisings in the wake of the coup, but they were unsuccessful. Although this new republic would last for 40 years, it created an instability which resembled that present when Dom Pedro had first come to power. There were periodic rebellions from monarchists, and by a group known as the Canudos in Bahia. These were largely made up of rural poor and freed slaves, and were led by a strange prophet-like figure who resembled Jesus and criticised both the church and the state for their treatment of the lower classes. In 1930, the Republican government was itself overthrown in a coup, which saw a dictatorship established. The story of that dictatorship, led by Getúlio Vargas, is an interesting and complex one, which we will look at next episode. And so, in some ways it was uniquely Brazilian. In other ways, though, Brazil's history was now starting to converge with its Spanish-American neighbours. Its experience of the 19th century had stood out as very different to the rest of the continent, but now it will be influenced by many of the same trends as those neighbours. The dictator phenomenon, then, extended to the tip of South America. And it's mainly South America we've looked at when discussing it so far. It was, however, also strong in the north. Again, here its emergence and form were affected by the proximity to the USA. We've already seen how Mexico was unique, as it ousted a dictator through revolution, and replaced it with what is sometimes called the perfect dictatorship, a system where no individual retained power, but the institutional revolutionary party acted as a sort of common dictatorship, which held elections and changed its leaders, but retained power for decades. I will quickly mention three more examples, though, which were more typical of Central America and the Caribbean. Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, Somoza in Nicaragua, and Batista in Cuba all came to power through military careers and coups against their respective countries' presidents. Trujillo and Somoza were actually members of their country's newly formed National Guards, created as part of US policy in the wake of interventions. There had actually been a couple of invasions of Nicaragua, driven in part by the desire to prevent a European power from building a canal there, which would rival the one the USA had helped dig in Panama, and partly to defeat a guerrilla leader, Sandino, whose manifesto was influenced by the Mexican Revolution and who deeply resented US interference. If they had wanted to keep the Europeans out there, in the Dominican Republic, the US wanted to ensure that national debts were paid to European creditors. In Cuba's case, the US had of course helped them win independence from Spain, and it retained the right to intervene again if it considered it necessary. They indeed exercised this right in the coming decades, and Cuban politics were generally turbulent. An attempt was made by an Afro-Cuban group to declare independence at one point, and a combination of striking communists, rebellious sugar workers, and discontented soldiers brought one government down. At other points, a pro-US president helped to turn the island into a playground for Americans, and the New York Italian Mafia entrenched itself into the entertainment industry. With his coup, Batista managed to establish order, and like Trujillo and Somoza, his administration lasted for decades. All three towed a careful line, appeasing the US and its economic interests, while cracking down with extreme repression on dissidents at home. None of these men had explicitly fascist ideologies, and their entertainment of those foreign economic interests demonstrated a pragmatic commitment to free market economics. I may change my mind when I research the subject further, but it appears that their rule was more about simple power than a coherent ideology, although of course you can draw comparisons to the authoritarianism of fascism. So hopefully that explains how the big ideas sweeping the globe at the time affected Latin America. But before finishing off this episode, there are a couple of last things we should talk about, which helped shape this and subsequent periods. The first was immigration. During the second half of the 19th century and the early 20th, huge numbers of people left Europe. Alongside the USA, which is famous for this, people looked for new lives in places like Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. Latin America was no different, and like those places, many came from Italy and Germany in particular. The Italians headed in largest numbers to Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, southern Brazil and Paraguay. So too did the Germans, and not too long ago I visited a town near Cordoba in Argentina, which was bizarrely and authentically German in its architecture and culture. The Germans went everywhere though, including the mountains of Central America and Mexico, where they were particularly involved in establishing coffee and beer industries. Large numbers of Jews from Russia and Eastern Europe also came to the Rio de la Plata, and today Buenos Aires has one of the largest Jewish populations of any city in the world. Alongside this were smaller numbers of people from pretty much every European country. Basques, Spaniards, and Jews contributed to the population of Antioquia, the part of Colombia where Medellin is, and in Bogotá, there are plenty of very English-looking houses around the area of Chapinero. More British people came to work in Argentina, doing things like organising the building of the railways, and their biggest contribution to Latin American culture was of course bringing football, which the Argentines, Uruguayans and Brazilians quickly made their own. Argentina at the time was actually predicted to be the next superpower, set to rival the USA, and so it was particularly attractive to immigrants. People didn't just come from Europe, however, although sometimes national governments attempted to favour immigration from that continent. Conflict in the declining Ottoman Empire, particularly in today's Lebanon and Syria, led many Arabs to migrate. There were many famous Latin Americans with Arabic ancestry. Shakira and El Salvador's President Bukele are two examples, and Brazil has the largest Arab diaspora outside of the Middle East. One of Chile's major football clubs is called Palestino, as it was founded by Palestinians, and Al Pastor Tacos are another obvious cultural contribution. Many people arrived in Latin America from Japan and China as well. Brazil also has the largest Japanese population outside of Japan, largely concentrated in Sao Paulo, and the Fujimori family of politicians and presidents in Peru also have roots there. Pulling the Japanese to Brazil was the need for workers on the coffee plantations, particularly once Italy made attempts to stop its population from draining away. Pushing them there was the poverty and overpopulation caused by the economic changes which occurred with the end of feudalism in their homeland. The Chinese also came to fill labour gaps, often working in places like those coffee plantations in Brazil and building railways in Panama. If you want to know more about the Chinese presence in Mexico, you can listen to Hugo Wong talk about it in episode 97, America's Lost Chinese. As a whole, Latin America needed people, and so it had a fairly open policy to migration. As I mentioned, though, there was sometimes discrimination, as governments sought to control who entered the region. All of this immigration, combined with the World Wars, finally kick-started the industrialization and urbanization process which had occurred the century before elsewhere. In truth, the process had had its first splutters into life during the latter part of the 1800s, most notably in Brazil and Mexico, and slowly creating the beginning of a middle class. But it was the World Wars which really accelerated things. Immigrants were joined by people from the countryside, and so the cities began to fill up. The powers fighting the World Wars needed supplies, and so Latin America stepped in to provide some of them, and this led to the growth of factories. Next time we will move on to the second part of the 20th century, and observe the next stage of the battle of ideologies. Now that we've briefly looked at what the World Wars did for Latin America at home, though, we will begin with a quick look at the involvement of its nations in the conflict itself. If you've enjoyed this episode, and the podcast as a whole, and you're looking for a way to help out, one thing you can do is leave a review, wherever you get your podcast from. It really helps new people discover the show. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done this, and thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.